Some of what I want to do is to share with you some fairly well-established concepts, which many of you will know, but then I want to sort of go off at a bit of an angle, a bit of a tangent, with some of the ingredients. Now, I'm sure that all of you who've been exposed to some church growth teaching will know about 3P evangelism. But nevertheless, I'm going to remind you about it for a few moments, and especially... I'll have £2 on the 2:30, please. Have most of you seen that? Most of you have seen that kind of stuff, haven't you? The 3P evangelism.
Yeah,
most of you will have seen that. Let's just run through it very quickly, just in case you've forgotten. Basically, the argument is that evangelism begins with the first P of presence. In other words, that we earn a right to speak because of our help, because of the ways in which we serve people. So that, if you like, the message of love is given a context. Presence evangelism. And that's the first building block of the evangelistic process. The second ingredient of the evangelistic process is proclamation. In other words, we don't just leave it at good works. We don't just leave people to guess at why we're doing things. We also engage in the process of giving an explanation for why we're doing things. But the process does not end there. It goes on to persuasion evangelism. I don't like that term, persuasion evangelism. It sounds as if you're involved in twisting somebody's arm up their back. And of course, the real truth is they've just used that word because it happens to have a P in the beginning of it. In fact, it's much more about the discipleship process than it is about persuasion per se. Actually, what it's doing is it's taking somebody from the point where they have made a commitment to Christ and moving them from there to the point where they've also got a much more understanding about the walk of faith. It will be taking them through baptism and into some kind of active service in the church. Okay, so that's the basic building blocks, if you like, of 3P evangelism. And each of these, as you'll see from the chart behind me, in a sense can be measured. When we're dealing with presence evangelism, we can number the people reasonably accurately that our church would reach in some way or another through the course of a given week or a given month or a given year. How many people are helped is, if you like, the measurement for that. And I've certainly gone to quite a number of churches where actually when they start to sit down and add all these numbers up, the people they've touched by one means or another, they themselves are surprised at how high that figure is. And even then, they won't always know of everybody. I remember a friend of mine who was an Anglican vicar. He was leaving the parish, and it became general knowledge in the community, and somebody came and stopped him in the street and said, "Vicar, I'm terribly sorry you're going." And he thought, "Well, who on earth is this?" He couldn't remember ever meeting the lady before. And he said, "Well," he said, "you won't remember me, but some time ago, I phoned up the vicarage because my child was desperately ill, and I asked for prayer, and actually the curate came round, and he did pray for my child. My child, in fact, got better, and I've been praying in thanks to God ever since, and one of these days I'm going to turn up at church as well." Now, actually, the church was totally unaware, if you like, that this person existed. So there will be a certain number of people that you don't know about, but for the most part, you've probably got a pretty good idea of how many people are helped. Then you can probably also get some idea of how many people in the course of a year have not only been helped but have had some kind of presentation of the gospel, not just one that they will have heard, but in order to count, it needs to be one that they've also understood. And as you probably understand, there's quite a big difference sometimes between hearing and understanding. So an explanation of the gospel that it becomes clear they have understood. And just to give you an example of that, I remember one young man who went through a course of instruction, if you like, and at the end of it all he said, you know, I understand what you're saying, and as a matter of fact, I even believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, but I'm not going to become a Christian. Why not? Because it involves making changes in my life, and I don't want to do that. Now, I would definitely put him down as one who had heard and understood. But what we discover when we ask people to record that number of people in their church's life is that there is an amazing disparity between those who are helped and those who hear and understand. And I would go so far as to say that if you were able to say 2,000 people were helped, I would be pretty safe in saying that probably only 50 heard the gospel and understood. There is a huge disparity between those two figures. There's not usually quite so much disparity between the figure of those who have heard and understood and those who go on to be properly discipled. There's not usually such a big disparity, but there is a big disparity in the first two categories. Now, what does that suggest to you? It certainly suggests to me that actually there's a lot more that we could be doing in terms of following through the kinds of opportunities that are opened up by the myriad ways in which the church has contact with those in the community. All right, well, that's the sort of background, if you like, in terms of 3P evangelism, and it begins to give us a clue as to how we might follow up contacts that we make. But that's not the whole story by any means. There's also the issue of how receptive people are to the gospel. And once again, in church growth teaching, you will often get people talked about in terms of culture barriers. And I want to use some terminology, which again, I don't particularly like, but it's just useful shorthand. And the terminology, just for a moment, is E0 evangelism, E1 evangelism, E2 evangelism, and E3 evangelism. Now, just accept, I don't like it, but just accept that that's useful shorthand for the time being, okay? What do we mean by these phrases? E0 evangelism consists of those people who are very much like us. As a matter of fact, they're so much like us that they are in the church, but they've never actually made a commitment to Christ. So they're like us in every regard, except that they've not made a commitment to Christ. They're socially like us, they're like us in lots of cultural ways, even to the point that they attend the same church, but they haven't made a commitment to Christ. Then there's those who are in that category, E1 evangelism, and they are like us in every respect, except that they are the other side of what has been called the stained glass barrier. In other words, they are culturally removed because they don't attend a church, and as a matter of fact, the culture that they're part of is moving further and further away from the church. So they're like us in the sense that they're the same social group, they're the same racial group, they speak the same language, and the only difference is that they don't attend church, E1 evangelism. E2 evangelism is where people are a little bit further removed than that. They are unlike us in some other significant respect. That other significant respect might be that they are a different socioeconomic group, or it might be that they speak English very well and they are otherwise part of the community, but they are perhaps part of an ethnic minority, second or third generation. And then finally, there's E3 evangelism, where there are those people who are unlike us in many respects. They are people who might have difficulty speaking English at all, and there are significant cultural barriers. They might be of another religion. They would certainly have different customs, different eating habits, all sorts of differences between us and them. Now, the fact of the matter is that for decades and decades and decades, most churches have only ever reached people in the E0 bracket. In other words, what has happened is that the church has gone through a process of helping people. Do you remember what we were talking about? Presence evangelism. And that presence evangelism has drawn people into the general orbit of the church because of the culture in which we have lived. Notice, have lived. Those people have been drawn into a pattern of church attendance without necessarily making a commitment. Most evangelism has been conducted in that area. And as a matter of fact, most of the crusade evangelism, most of that kind of evangelism, in fact, has produced converts from that kind of group. The second group that we can speak about is a group from which converts do come, but they are not nearly as numerous as the converts in the group E0. For most of our church life, it has to be said that very few churches make very many converts, if any, in groups E2 and E3. That is what we might call cross-cultural evangelism, and frankly, very few churches are skilled or able to do that. In other words, if there is a significant difference between ourselves and the people we're trying to reach, most people, most churches are not able to make that jump. One of the great tragedies that you can see in the United Kingdom, if you care to, is to look on the vast housing estates, which we call council housing. I don't know, what do you call it here? There is a phrase that you have. Housing commission, that's the phrase, yeah. And if you look on our equivalent of housing commission estates, up and down England, you'll find lots and lots of non-conformist churches which have been put on those areas by those nearby middle-class churches who took the view, look, these people need a Christian witness, they need the gospel, we'll plant a church there. And what happens is that well-meaning middle-class people pay for a church, attend it, and then guess what happens? Nobody from the community joins it. Does that happen here? And then what happens is that 20 or 30 years later, when you visit the church, you'll see that, first of all, the building looks a bit more run down, and sometimes there's even barbed wire to stop the kids stealing the roof and things like this. And then you'll see, if you go inside, that it's basically the same group of middle-class people there, but they're 20 or 30 years older, they're 20 or 30 years more tired, and, you know, they've come to the conclusion, we failed. Why have we failed? Because the people in this community are unreceptive to the gospel. Isn't that what they say? I went to a church like that a few years ago to preach, and it happened to be an anniversary service. It happened to be a Church of Christ. And I said to them, I see that you're located exactly between Housing Commission property and private property, and I see from the congregation that everybody lives in the private property. I said, that doesn't surprise me, but have you any comment to make about that? And they said, well, yeah, it's very simple. the people in the Housing Commission property are just completely unreceptive. They just don't want to know. I said nothing, but I didn't believe it. And I went back a couple of years later, and I said, I noticed that you've got a group meeting in the evenings in your church building. Oh, yes, he said, we rent it out to another group. I said, can you tell me about that group? I said, it's really strange, they said. Very strange indeed. What's strange about it? Well, a couple of years ago, this woman on the Housing Commission estate became a Christian. And what she decided to do was open up her home to her friends and neighbours. And people from the estate started to become Christians. And they became so numerous that they couldn't all get in the home. And so they asked if they could rent our church. I said, how many are there now? 150. 150. Three times the size of the supposedly receptive group that met in the morning. Now, of course, they had lots of negative things to say about this group because, after all, it wasn't a proper service at all. Certainly wasn't a proper Church of Christ, I can tell you. Because, after all, when they assembled for worship, before they even worshipped, people would just wander in, dressed as they were, and they would do things like say, oh, can you pray for me because I've got such and such a problem? It was so unstructured, it couldn't possibly be a decent church, but anyway, there you are. It wasn't that they were unreceptive to the gospel, ever. They were simply unreceptive to becoming middle class. Now, the fact of the matter is, it is very difficult for us, not impossible, but it's difficult for us to cross cultural boundaries, to cross cultural barriers. And the first thing that we ought to point out in that regard is that actually those who are gifted as cross-cultural communicators are extremely rare animals. Those who are gifted as cross-cultural communicators are extremely rare animals. And I actually don't think that we should beat our breasts and have a tremendous guilt complex about the fact that we're not gifted as cross-cultural evangelists. The fact is that such animals are quite rare. But what it does mean is that we need to take account of some of this stuff in terms of the strategies we operate. So, one of the first questions that we need to ask ourselves is simply the question, thinking about the people that we're attempting to reach, thinking about the people who are in our immediate community, are they people who are E0, E1, E2, E3. So what I'd like you to do for a moment, if you would, is do just that. Think about that for a moment. And if you've got a bit of paper handy, or if you can just record it on your memory for a moment. All right, let me just start to ask you the question, and maybe we can just do this first part by just putting up your hand. Would you say that the majority of people that you're trying to reach are in either the E0 or the E1 category? If that's true for you, would you put your hand up? E0 or E1? Okay. Would you put up your hand if a good number of people that you're trying to reach are in the E2 or E3 category? Okay, that's what I would normally expect, but actually, in fact, there's probably more people putting their hands up for the E2, E3 category than I would have expected, so that's in itself quite interesting. All right, let's just stay with that a minute. What I want us to begin to do is to start to put together the activities in our church. Do you remember we were talking about presence activities, proclamation activities, persuasion activities, the three P's. Let's think about the activities in our church. How would we describe those activities in those sorts of terms? And who, in terms of E0, E1, E2, E3 evangelism, who do those activities reach? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a chart up in a moment, and I'm going to suggest that you begin to plot on that chart, if you just copy the chart down on a piece of paper, and plot on that chart the activities in your church, see where they would start to fall. Now, I'll put the chart up, and then we can make sure that you understand the exercise before we move on. Okay, there should be 12 boxes there. Can you see that? And it's a bit difficult to see on the wall, but hopefully you can just make it out. Across the top, you'll see the words Presence, Proclamation, Persuasion, and down the left-hand side, E0, E1, E2, E3. Now, start to think about the activities in your church. Okay, it could be mother and toddlers group, it could be Sunday school, it could be youth club, it could be all sorts of things. Which one of those boxes would you put those activities in? Now, what I'd like you to do is put in as many of the activities your church runs as you possibly can in where you think they are mostly having impact. All right? I'll give you 5 minutes to do that. Off you go. Okay, there's one or two people still writing, which is interesting in itself, actually, if you're still writing, that's good. So you can maybe just keep writing a little bit as we're beginning to get some feedback on this. Let me ask the question, is there anybody at all that hasn't managed to put anything in that top left-hand box, the E0 presence box? Anybody at all? All right. How many people have got more than 10 things in that box? Anybody got more than 10? Anybody got more than 5? In that top left-hand box. Anybody got... Well, what have you got? I'm surprised that you haven't got more than... What have you got? Yes. Pardon? You've got more than 5. Ah, right, okay. I thought there'd be somebody. Oh, you had more than 5. Right, okay. Okay, so there are a number of people that had got more than 5. Is it... how many people just got like 1 or 2 things in that box? Okay, right, that's interesting. All right, moving across there, E0 Proclamation. Have most people got something in that box? Anybody got nothing at all in that? One, just one thing. Okay, you've got something in there. How does that compare with what you've got in E0 box? Right, okay. Okay. Let's move across to persuasion. Have most people got something in the E0 persuasion box? Most people got something in there? Yeah? Many things? A number? Okay. All right, let's move down. E1, how many people have got 5 or more things in the E1 presence? Yeah? Yeah? A number? Okay. All right. E1 proclamation. How many people got... Everybody got something in there? Yeah? No, some haven't. Okay. What, just one thing? Okay. What about E1 persuasion? How about that one? Have you mostly got something in there? Right, we're more divided there. Okay. All right, let's take E2 presence. How many have you got in there? Anybody got anything in there? Put your hand up if you've got something in there. All right. Small number got something in there. E2 proclamation. Put up your hand if you've got something in there. Okay. What is it you've got in there? Sorry? Right. Okay. And that's working with a group that's significantly different in some respect. Okay. E2 persuasion. Anybody got anything in there? All right. E3, presence evangelism. Yep. Okay. How many things? One. All right. E3, proclamation evangelism. Anybody? Nobody? E3, persuasion, almost certainly nobody. Yeah? Right. So in other words, what we discover from that is that the bulk of the activity is up in the top left-hand area. And as you come diagonally down that, it peters out until by the time we get to the bottom right-hand box, there's nothing. All right, well, let's just unpack what that might mean for us in the evangelistic process. As I indicated to you at the beginning, for the majority of the life of the church in the Western world, most evangelism has been concentrated in the E0 area. People who will naturally come to church. It is almost always the case as well that a lot of our evangelism has been in the presence area. We don't like doing proclamation and persuasion nearly as much as we like doing the presence evangelism. Fine. It's worked for years. But there's a problem. And the problem simply is this, that because of the way in which our culture is moving, the number of people on the Christian fringe in that E0 area, which is really another way of describing the fringe of the church, the number of people in the Christian fringe is declining and declining and declining. So that actually what's happening is we're fishing from a much smaller pool than we ever have done in the past. And what that means is that churches which are growing grow most often, now this is not the only way they grow, but most churches which are growing because A, they know how to fish that pool effectively, B, they're very good at fishing the fringes of other people's churches, that's true, and C, they happen to live in an area where lots of people are moving in and will easily come to their church in any case. Okay? So in other words, it's nice that they're there because they're able to help the church absorb new Christians who would be looking for a church anyway, existing Christians who would be looking for a church anyway, but in terms of kingdom growth, that's not quite so obvious. And I visit many, many churches. In fact, I could tell you of one church, one of the largest Baptist churches in the United Kingdom, where I asked them to do the analysis of the number of new converts in a church that could attract 2,000 people on special occasions. And they discovered that there were 12 converts in a year. They could attract 2,000 people on special occasions, but they only actually had 12 converts in a year. That's not untypical, I'm sorry to have to say. In other words, if we're going to be effective in the evangelistic process, there are two issues we've got to take on board. The first issue that we've got to take on board is that actually most of our evangelism in the future is going to have to be done with the E1 group, not with the E0 group, if we're going to get kingdom growth. That's the first message. And related to that is the simple fact that that group is actually headed in a direction which takes them further away from the church, not closer to it. In other words, we've got to do something radically different about our style of outreach, our style of worship, our style of group encounter, just about everything we do if we're going to be effective in that group E1. And that is actually the most effective group, or at least that's the group that's going to be the most effective for us to concentrate on. And the second lesson that comes out from that is that actually there are increasingly large numbers of people in the E2 and E3 areas who our churches will not reach, and the only way they will be reached is if somebody plants a church amongst those groups. So there's a huge challenge for us in fulfilling the Great Commission. The Christian fringe is shrinking, so we've got to find ways of attracting people who are quite like us, but who are not Christians at all. And secondly, there are many people coming into our communities who are quite unlike us and need churches to be planted amongst them if the Great Commission is going to be effectively fulfilled. So let's just pause there for a moment. Are there any things that you want to come back on in terms of what we've dealt with so far? Anything at all? Well, chaplaincy would obviously not result in a church plant per se, but it could result in converts. But then the question comes, what do you do with those converts? And actually, in most cases, it's going to be too big a jump for people from a chaplaincy situation to come back into an existing church. So that does raise the question as to whether an effective chaplaincy leads to a church plant. And actually, there are many, many cases where it does. Now, a church plant doesn't have to mean a separate building, but it might just mean a separate worship service in the same building, but with a different group in mind. And let's face it, there are many, many young people that we're only going to reach if we put on a very different kind of worship encounter, worship experience for them. Because with the best will in the world, they are simply going to struggle with the kind of worship that will work for most other adults. Where people who are Christians are just moving into the area, and so you just pick them up naturally, which is great. The problem with it is it gives you the illusion of growth, which isn't actually kingdom growth. I'm not against it. I wouldn't turn those people away. But it can make us feel pretty comfortable instead of concentrating on kingdom growth. As seen from the people who set up the church, they would be E2s. In other words, there would be one thing that would be significantly different, i.e., in this case, class, socioeconomic background. So E2 is actually quite a hard culture bridge to make. Yeah, I think that classifies as an E2. I think it classifies as an E2. It is a significant culture jump. Yep. Right, thanks for that comment. That's helpful. Did everybody catch that? Okay, well, what I want to do is move on one further step now, if we may, and that is simply to try and address this situation or this issue that actually when we look at these boxes, we tend to have far more activity in the E0, in the presence boxes than we have in the proclamation and in the persuasion boxes. In other words, there is a huge fall-off in numbers between those who our church is touching through some kind of service activity and the point that we get to in terms of proclamation and persuasion. What can we do about that? Let me just put another chart up if I can. And again, I hope that you can see that on the wall, but you'll see that there are two axes on that chart. The one axis is what you might call a resistance receptivity scale on the bottom, and that relates strongly to this whole presence, proclamation, persuasion activity. In other words, what happens in the area of receptivity to the gospel is that those, the more that people have contact with us, hopefully, the more receptive they are. Now, that's not always true, depending on what we're like, I suppose. But hopefully that's true, and generally, as a general rule, it is true. And the more contact that people have with us, the more receptive they are. In other words, it begins to produce a warmth towards the church, and therefore some degree of openness towards the message. But no matter how warm people are in terms of the Christian message, actually they don't become Christians unless there is also a significant degree of content in terms of their understanding. Now, what happens very frequently in my own country, and I just would be interested to know if this is also what happens in Australia, is that I come across church after church after church who will run activities for the community, and then they get frustrated because they say, but nobody's ever come to Christ through that activity. Does that happen here? So they'll put on a youth group and they'll say, yeah, but nobody's ever come to Christ. Or they'll put on a mother and toddler group and they say, yeah, but nobody's ever come to Christ, and so on and so forth. And there's a tremendous level of frustration building up. But actually there's a misunderstanding here. And the misunderstanding is simply this. The point about those presence activities is that the intention is not actually to draw people directly from that activity into an encounter with Christ. The intention, if you like, is to move people along this scale. In other words, to help them become more receptive to hearing. A mother and toddler group by itself does not proclaim the gospel. A youth group by itself does not proclaim the gospel. They give testimony to the fact that we care, but in itself, it doesn't tell people what the gospel message is. So what we have to do, if we want to ensure that that comes about, is we have to make sure that that present strategy connects with a proclamation strategy. So if you like, the red line can represent a present strategy, and the green line starts to represent a proclamation strategy. So what happens then is that they grow not only in their warmth towards the Christian church, but they grow in their understanding and knowledge of the Christian message. So they're going up this scale. First of all, minus 10, they know nothing about the Christian faith whatsoever. Minus 9, they're aware that there are such things as Christians. Minus 8, they're beginning to ask questions, and so on and so forth, until finally they get up here somewhere around the minus 1 plus 1, and they begin to get to the point where they can make a decision for Christ. Now, what would one of those strategies be? Well, let's just take an example. Let's imagine that you were running a youth group, and let's imagine that it was a completely open group. Anybody could come. Hopefully, what that would do is build relationships between the youth leaders and the youth group in such a way that it would be possible to say, we are going to be running a separate group for those who want to know more about the Christian faith. It won't be the same group. Because in a sense, that would be to betray trust, wouldn't it? If you've actually said to people, look, we're going to serve you, but actually we've got a secret agenda, which we're not going to tell you about until you're trapped. That's not honest. But what is honest is out of the established relationship to say, would you like to come to another activity? The other activity has a clear proclamation intent. And then, of course, what then can happen at the end of that is you challenge people and you say those who would like to take this further might want to go into, I don't know, a class for preparation for baptism or something like that. And that's the persuasion strategy represented by the blue line. So, in other words, one of the things that we need to do is look at our activities and ask the question, how are we connecting? What are some of the connections we're making between the things that we do to make contact with people and the things that we do to explain the faith? Are there clear connections? Are we really taking advantage of the opportunities that we have? Equally well, we might say, actually, we've got some great proclamation and persuasion structures in place. The problem is we've got no audience to address it to. In that case, the question would be, where are the presence activities? Are we attracting the people from the groups that we think we can realistically reach so that we've got that group from which we can draw those contacts in order to pull into some of these other activities? Now, again, that's not exactly revolutionary, and anybody with a bit of common sense could obviously work that out. But it's surprising how few churches actually have thought through the implications of what it is they're doing in their regular program. So one of my suggestions would simply be that actually use this model to put it over, if you like, your existing program as a means of helping you identify the gaps in the program and those particular areas where there actually are opportunities but connections need to be made.